Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, and Jump in Tucson Monday's theme is Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the University of Arizona, including student projects and learning and outcomes, as well as top-level performances by artists and athletes, and especially top-tier research going on with faculty and scientists at the University of Arizona. Our guests this morning are Dr. Basab Goswami. Congratulations on your new doctorate.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Welcome to the world of doctorhood. I love that's great, PhD. And Dr. Vitaly Yurkiv, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. So let's start first with you, Dr. Vitaly Yurkiv. You are the Assistant Professor of Aerospace and Mechanical Engineering at the University of Arizona. Could you tell us a little bit just your journey of how you got to the U of A and what your responsibilities are now?
Yes, thank you so much. Yes, so I started my journey at University of Arizona 2 years ago. So I moved here from Chicago to aerospace and mechanical engineering. So I was interviewed and hired here to work on energy storage and in particular rechargeable batteries. Since we have right now rechargeable batteries everywhere, you see electric vehicles, now electric airplanes going into our lives. So I was hired here to start and continue work at the University of Arizona related to rechargeable batteries, and in particular to study their thermal response. So how we are working in harsh climate. So here in Tucson, we have perfect example of harsh climate. So we are studying how this climate, so hot and dry climate, influences battery performance in different industrial and also residential applications.
And wouldn't batteries also are laptops and cell phones, are those the same kind of batteries, overheating and so forth? At least I'm thinking about putting them on planes and the FAA be concerned about batteries heating up. Are they still a concern, or is that something different?
Yes, we saw exactly the same batteries, so you cannot check in your bag with your laptop inside, so it is not allowed. Since a couple of years, we had a couple of incidents in past where battery operating devices were exploding on board. Mm-hmm. So yes, we saw exactly the same batteries. And yes, we do also focus on these types of batteries.
So this affects not only those people that are driving an electric vehicle or a corporation that has vehicles and machines that are battery powered. This goes right to the everyday American that has a laptop or a cell phone. This battery issue of overheating is something that is personal to people. So that's an interesting thing. Speaking of personal, one of the things you do as the lead investigator for this recent study is to have doctoral students who are in your purview, who you help lead and investigate. And one of those is the recently graduated Dr. Basab Goswami. So before I ask Basab to talk to us a little bit, tell us about him as a doctoral student under your charge and you being his advisor for looking at this overheating. Was he a good student?
Yes, he was actually the perfect student. He joined our university 3 years ago, and he completed all necessary work, and he published a couple of really good papers, and also he presented successfully our results on many international conferences, which got recognition internationally, national and internationally. So as a result of his work, he published this year two peer-reviewed papers, and which got a lot of attention and a lot of actually citation right now, despite being only a couple of months. And 2 months ago, yes, he successfully finished the work, and unfortunately he left, he found a job. It was not good for us, but as I say, I'm always happy for my students' success.
Well, great. Dr. Goswami, where are you employed? What job did you take?
So I have been employed at a startup company called Richtop Group as a senior battery simulation engineer. And I've also been given the chance to lead the product development team. So we have our own in-house battery simulation software.
Cool.
And I'm kind of the only PhD right now in that group. So they have given me the task to lead that team and, you know, develop more capabilities for the simulation tool and henceforth, yeah.
So as I understand it, I'm not a battery expert, but you recently were published in the Journal of Power Sources, and the study that you both were working on was about this overheating and what I would call the domino effect of if a cell begins to heat up and so forth, it could create a situation where the other up to 1,000 cells might all begin to start heating up, and that creates a fire, and that creates a problem, and could result in something tragic. So how did you come up with the idea that you could figure out which cell is going to heat up and how to mitigate that?
So our idea is that so every cell, they have like certain degradation mechanisms,
right,
because of which they can go to thermal runaway, but it's not that straightforward. So what happened, let's say consider...
They're degrading, that's how the power is created,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So as they degrade, there's more, the power is then... funneled into whatever device that it's
yeah,
driving.
But apart from that, like there are certain parasitic reactions, you know, that we don't want actually, but it happens. So when this happens, like lithiums are consumed and, you know, the cyclable amount of lithium gets decreased over time, but it also gets to, you know, certain exothermic reactions. When I say exothermic, that means releases heat. So when it releases heat, so what happens, certain other degradation mechanisms start occurring, and, you know, a series of chain reactions start occurring, due to which, you know, the temperature can escalate and kind of form exponential nature. So that's how we say that, okay, now the battery can go to thermal runaway. And when this happens, and as I mentioned, like each degradation mechanism has a certain onset temperature that, okay, when let's say this temperature is reached, then, you know, this exothermic reaction can take place. So when one of the cells gets heated, the adjacent cell also, you know, take up that heat, and they have their own degradation, this kind of chemical reactions. And then finally, like series of chain reactions, all the cells catch fire and it's a big explosion.
Right. And so if you can mitigate this by finding out or predicting which of these cells is going to go hot, then you have a better chance of mitigating a potential fire or an explosion if you can do that. And so, Dr. Yukov, you were mentioning earlier that that we do this with machines, but that it's pretty amazing how accurate those predictions turned out to be with the algorithm that was developed.
Yes. So we don't know, you know, the explosion of these single cells always stochastic. So in past, it was believed that we are not able to forecast or predict which mm-hmm. battery will explode and the whole, your laptop or car will get on fire. But Basab developed a so-called AI-driven, artificial intelligence-driven algorithm, which actually tracks the change of some parameters which are leading to this explosion or overheating. And now we are able to correct. So in each battery operating device has battery management system. So battery management system is a small software which manages how battery should be used.
Great.
So now based on...
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that algorithm and how this predictive force is important for understanding the use of batteries as more and more of them come online. We'll be back after the break. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, your host. This is the Monday Wonder Series, where we talk about good things going on at the University of Arizona. And one of those things is the importance of... prediction of batteries and car batteries and laptop batteries and phone batteries, and making sure they don't cause fires and the tragic result of those things that we've heard some reports about. With us is Dr. Basab Goswami. Good morning again. And we also have Dr. Vitaly Yurkiv, who is with the University of Arizona. He's an assistant professor of aerospace and mechanical engineering. So recently, the Biden administration just announced a $1.7 billion fund for research on batteries, some additional research. So lots of money's been pouring in from the Department of Engineering, the Department of Energy, about battery technology and what do we do. So Dr. Goswami, will your company here, the startup in Tucson, will it be affected at all by that $1.7 billion? And obviously you're trying to get some of that money so you can go on with some research, right?
Yeah, so likewise. So I am supposed to write a lot of proposals for different sort of fundings, you know, let's say DOD or DOE.
They hired you and said, now you go write some proposals and see if we can get some money in here. Huh?
Yeah. And actually, like before I joined, actually, we already won one DOE SBIR proposal. So mm-hmm. SBIR is Small Business Innovation Research.
Great.
So we already had one. And but right now, like we are trying to, you know, get as much as funding as possible because of our like simulation tool, because we are a small business. So, yeah, we need funding. So.
Are you headquartered in Tucson?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Dr. Yurkiv, this is pretty important that we see this learning and this research going on, and then have it transfer to companies who stay in Tucson and help advocate on behalf of this learning that's going on. So it's great to have a company like his in Tucson working in concert with the university. Is that correct?
Yes, it's absolutely correct. It's always university-like industry, and especially local industry support.
And will the university benefit from any federal funding here? The $1.7 billion is a small amount of money spread around a bunch of industries and companies and so forth. But certainly, being in the aerospace and mechanical engineering portal, you're probably getting some information on and some funding from the Department of Energy to help you with these projects, correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct. This work is actually supported by National Science Foundation and also by Department of Defense. So Defense established program to stimulate competitive research, so-called DEPSCoR. So we are getting significant amount of support from different governmental organizations.
And that's one of your jobs as leading these investigations and so forth, is to manage that money wisely and make sure that the doctoral students and the people that are assisting on these teams are focusing in on the information to give us the results that you've gotten on this project, which is to kind of predict these batteries and how they are going to, they're going to be so prevalent in the next 10 years. This is a really important thing, right?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It is projected that electric vehicles and or in general rechargeable battery operating devices will be everywhere. So we will be using them on daily basis in 10 years. 90% of our life will be dependent on rechargeable batteries, which is why it's very important to start studying thermal response of these batteries now.
So a thermal response is an issue with the lithium batteries. Is there another technology of batteries that is being worked on that is something that could be maybe less flammable or something? Or are we pretty much kind of like gasoline at the time that we invented the combustible engine? This is what we're using, is gasoline and the gasoline combustible engine. Are we kind of, this is the battery system that we're going to be using for the next 25, 50 years, and this is it? And so we got to work on making sure that we do a good job of managing the thermal responses?
That's partly correct. We are significantly depending on lithium batteries right now, and we have to make them safer because we have a lot of lithium in the United States. Mm-hmm. So we have to benefit from having a lot of lithium to create these batteries. But there are different types of batteries, and there is actually companies in Tucson which are working on alternative batteries to lithium batteries. So there are some alternative solutions to these types of batteries.
So as a guy that drives a car that's a regular gasoline combustible engine, I go up to a convenience store to fill up my car, I either choose the unleaded gas or I can choose diesel. Will it be down the line, different kinds of batteries will require different kinds of charging stations, or will they try to be universal? So if you plug into a charging station, boom, doesn't matter if it's lithium or some other thing, it's going to charge the same way? Will that be a concern down the line?
It's not going to be a concern in future, but right now it is a concern.
Right.
So different automaker, they produce different charging station and different charging plugs. So right now, government is trying to unify everything that we use everywhere at the same charging standards. So it is going quite well. And most of our right now charging station, we have universal plugs, but it's not uniform across the United States yet.
So Dr. Goswami, when you and your team came up and came up with this algorithm and this idea of how to predict maybe the thermal reaction between these cells and these batteries, how did you develop the algorithm to make those predictions? How was that all? How did you think that through and say, if we can come up with some way to predict this, then we can solve this problem maybe down the line? How did that come to you? And did it come to you in a dream one night, or how did you figure that out?
No, it wasn't definitely a one-night dream, but let me explain you from the start where this idea actually came from.
Right.
let's stay about talking about predicting a weather of a certain place.
Right.
It depends on two things: the spatial location, where the location, like Tucson has a different kind of weather, and let's say Chicago has a different kind of weather. So it depends on space, and it depends also on the time, because at different time of the year the weather is different, right? This gave us an idea about how, if we can use this similar ideology in our work, because in batteries, like these hot spots that create the thermal runaway progression, so they always come from a point inside a battery. Now predicting the location of the point is very important, because that's where you get to know, okay, from here there is a possibility that, you know, thermal runaway could be triggered. So it also depends on space, and eventually, since we are operating the battery for different charging and discharging cycles, so the temperature changes with time as well. So it's a similar kind of format, you can say. Mm-hmm. Like it depends on space and also on time. But no one used that idea in this battery research, actually, for predicting weather of a certain place, or for predicting, let's say, traffic speed. Mm-hmm. Like for the particular time of the day, the traffic speed are different, and also at different highways, the speeds are different, right? So we use the similar idea. And based on that, we then started thinking, okay, what kind of machine learning technologies can take into account space and time? And from that, we developed our framework.
That's pretty interesting that you would think that through. And that's a good analogy with different weather in different parts of the country. And so how will this go to market then? How will you take this idea of being able to predict what part of the cell is going to have a thermal issue and maybe start that domino effect? How do you take that to the market now that you have the research done? Where does it go from here?
So before talking about, so in sophisticated EVs, they have their own BMS, right? Like battery management systems. Right. So what we can do is we can on the go, when we are driving the car, we can train the, like the AI network based on the BMS system to record the temperature changes within the battery with time. And based on that training data set, it can have the capability to, in the future, it can predict, okay, like what's the temperature is gonna be, or if any of the cells can have that kind of a hotspot formation or like that, yeah.
So it's managing the system based on AI and machine learning, and teaching the system itself to shut down the battery or to separate the battery so that it doesn't heat up in that one particular cell.
Yeah, exactly. Basically shut down the battery, like cut off the electrical connection so that that battery is cut off from the entire electrical network. And if you talk about AI, it's already been used in certain, a lot of electric vehicles, like when you want, so object detections, when you are driving, let's say, a Tesla car, so in front of you, let's say there's a truck, it can directly detect what kind of a vehicle is in front of you. So definitely we are very much, we think that this kind of technology can also be adopted for the BMS system to predict the future temperature of the battery based on the past and, of course, other parameters of the battery.
It's interesting how the technology is all kind of coming together and helping in this situation with AI and learning. Well, Dr. Vitaly Yurkiv, Assistant Professor of Aerospace and Mechanical Engineering at the University of Arizona, thank you for joining us, and thank you for the good research you do. We're glad we have you at the University of Arizona, and we're glad that you are helping young doctoral students, now doctors, doing good work in our community. So thank you, Dr. Yurkiv, for being with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Goswami, we wish you well in your new enterprise as the grant writer for your new company and the chief researcher, the PhD, now the newly minted PhD. So thank you for being here. Congratulations on the attention that you're, that the team that you guys put together have on this. It's getting worldwide attention. And who knows, maybe someday they'll name an algorithm after you, the Goswami battery detection system or something like that.
So, yeah, hopefully. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate you coming and sharing your information with us today. If you'd like to be on Jump in Tucson, just go to jumpintucson.com, and we might have you on. You're listening to KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk, and this is the Wonder Series celebrating the good things at the University of Arizona. And we'll be back after the break on Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, And Jump in Tucson on Mondays talks about the wonder that goes on at the University of Arizona, the contributions that students and faculty and researchers make to the world, and the wonder that comes out of the academic learning and the research of a Research One institution. And one of those fascinating things that is in the news lately is the heat of mammals and the heat of animals of and what that means to them, and what the historical record is on that. And so with us is Dr. John Wines. He is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology in the College of Science at the University of Arizona. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you had an undergraduate lead author on the study that you did, and her name is Kristen Sabin, and she would love to be with us, but she took off for the hills and is now in Harvard University and is studying there and being in a master's program there, right?
No, she's actually starting her PhD.
I meant PhD. I knew that. I didn't mean to say master's. I meant PhD.
As of last week, I think.
Right. And so she's going to be. So let's talk a little bit about you and your journey to the University of Arizona and what a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology looks at, teaches, and researches.
Sounds great.
So, how'd you get to the U of A? What was that journey to get you there from where you were to where you are now?
Okay, so I grew up in Colorado, and I got my undergraduate degree at the University of Kansas, and then from there I got my PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, mm-hmm. and then I actually had two jobs before this one. I was a curator of herpetology, that's reptiles and amphibians, at the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh.
Wow.
And so I did that for 7.5 years. And then I went.
You were a snake oil salesman, is what you mean, right? Yeah.
I like snakes, but not the oil, not so much.
Yeah.
And after that, I was a ecology and evolution professor at Stony Brook University on Long Island.
Right.
And I was there for 10 years. And then starting at the beginning of 2013, I moved here. So I've actually been here longer than anywhere else now.
How did you get that that red flag that went up, and that flare that said, hey, there's a job open in Tucson. Why don't you come to the U of A? Were you recruited, or did you see it, or we go to a conference and meet somebody? Or
I guess it was partly at a conference, and mm-hmm. and a colleague of mine, Alex Bediev, you know, mm-hmm. said that they were talking about hiring somebody like me. And then he said, well, we could just, instead of hiring somebody like you, we could just hire you. And I love Tucson, and I would always have wanted to live here. So I was really excited.
That's great. So what does an ecology and evolutionary biology professor do? What is your specialty, and what do you look at, and what are you studying and researching?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I kind of have three main areas that I study. So one is like the origins of biodiversity. So like why there's more species in the tropics than in the temperate zone, and why there's more flowering plants than, say, mosses. So the questions like that. Another thing that I study is, one of my specialties is reptiles and amphibians. So I study a lot about their biology. And another thing that I study a lot lately is climate change and how it's going to affect the diversity of life on Earth.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
I know that it's a complex question with no one answer, but is there a generality of why there are more species in the equator region than there is, say, in the North Pole? What, obviously, it's colder in the North Pole, but...
it's a great question. Yeah, so we've just been doing some work on that lately, and it seems like part of the reason is the tropics used to be much more extensive,
mm-hmm.
and so... they've sort of shrunk back down in the last, 30, 40 million years. They've kind of shrunk back down, but it used to be that everywhere is the tropics. And so we think that that's part of the answer. And then a lot of things have just started off in the tropics, and they've just colonized the temperate zone more recently. Right. And so they've had less time to develop species richness here in the temperate, more temperate zones. And so that actually seems to work for both plants and animals. And so kind of leaning in on that hypothesis lately.
I think it's great the way you scientists talk about 30, 40 million years like it's a blink of the eye. Just yesterday, when to those of us novices, it seems like it's forever ago, but that's just a blip in the history of time, is it not?
Yeah, so one way to think about it is kind of like your typical species is at least a million years old.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you start to think about, thousands of species, you start to think, okay, we're going to be going back, tens of millions of years.
Right, and so a 30 or 40 million years ago is not that far away. It's a blip in the calendar.
In the geological timescale, totally. Yeah.
That's great. Well, tell us a little bit about Kristen Sabin, and she was your undergraduate student, and she's now off on her way to Her doctorate at Harvard, and she's going to be maybe a biologist or something like that.
Definitely, yeah. She's just a fantastic student. I think I first met her when she's a freshman, she was ostensibly a freshman, but she was 17, I guess. Right. She showed up in my office, but she couldn't really give me a straight answer about what year she was because she'd taken so many of the advanced placement tests that mm-hmm. when she arrived at UA, she was already a junior.
Yeah. And she left the U of A with a bunch of accolades, right?
She was like the
student of the year and those kind of things. She was amazing as a student and prolific too, right?
Yeah. So she did a bunch of research with me. She did a bunch of research for NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And
spent some summers with NASA as well.
That's right. Yeah. And so that was a lot of her time doing that. And then also doing actually a couple of papers with me. And mm-hmm. Doing all of that while also maintaining a perfect 4.0 grade point average.
Yeah, like you say, amazing that you can pull all that off and still get a 4.0. Well, you guys did a project where you were looking at the difference in what the body temperature of a species was would predict or is kind of a predicate for what kind of a diet that they would have. And so you and Kristen worked on this for some time and then recently published some information on this. So in general, again, 110 million years ago was a blip in time, but you've found out some interesting things, right?
I think so, yeah. So actually, we looked at tetrapods. So it's mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. And that tetrapods as a group actually go back 350 million years.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that we found out is that tetrapods started off as carnivores, and then they had lots of transitions, about 70 or so transitions to feeding only on plants, at least among the species that we looked at. And those all happened quite recently, just in mm-hmm. the past 110 million years or so. And
I notice how you say that quite recently, and it's 110 million years. Yeah.
But that's because we started off at 350
million,
right? So
yeah.
It's only in the last third or so of tetrapod evolution that these plant eaters, the current plant eaters, have been with us.
Right.
And so what's you might ask, what's special about 110 million years ago? And that's actually when flowering plants started to dominate plant communities.
And so that's in the tropics where this maybe all started, the flowering plants began to take over. And so it was easy for one of these species to walk up and say, well, there's something new and interesting. Let me see if I can eat that and not die. And so they ate it and found out that it was tasty, and they started eating it and said, oh, let's convert our diet to this. This is kind of fun.
Yeah. And what we found is that most of the origins of things, we say herbivory, that means pretty much eating mostly plants or over mm-hmm. 50% plants, that almost always starts off from a diet of both eating both plants and meat. So mm-hmm. you sort of go from being a carnivore to an omnivore, then being an herbivore.
Right. And so those species which are fully into herbivore now, were many millions of years ago, were they meat eaters or have some just kind of evolved from the get-go, they're herbivores?
There's a few transitions where things kind of start off as carnivores and they kind of go more or less straight to herbivores, but it's more typical because you start off as a carnivore and then you become an omnivore, sort of eating both, and then you eventually switch to being fully herbivore.
And that takes a couple million years, tens of millions of years
for that. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it, for that whole process to take place, yeah.
Well, when we come back after the break, we'll talk about temperature, of what a body temperature means and what the predictions or what that means for what type of diet an animal might take on based on that. And I'll even reveal some of the temperatures of some of the things I thought were pretty interesting to see what the average body temperature of an animal is. And I did a little bit of Googling beforehand to get that information. We're talking with Dr. John Wines, who is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology in the College of Science at the University of Arizona, and we're talking about body temperature and what that means for the kind of diet that a animal might have. And we'll come back after the break and talk some more about what that body temperature predicts for the warmer an animal, what kind of food they would probably be eating. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, and Jump in Tucson continues with the Wonder Series. But we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona in research and all other good things that come out of the U of A. We're talking with Dr. John Wines, who is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the College of Science in the University of Arizona. And we're talking about herbivores and the prediction of body temperature and what that means. One thing that you talked about was that you start as a carnivore, then maybe you go to an omnivore, and then maybe you turn into an herbivore. I've known many a person who started out their young life as eating baby food that was meat and vegetables and so forth, and then they get into their young years and they are kind of switched to vegetarianism or even veganism, and they stop eating meat, and many of them maintain that for a lifetime and a long time, but a lot of them come back to carnivore or omnivorism and, mm-hmm. and eat both. And so what about animals? Do they go from a carnivore to omnivore to herbivore, back to omnivore, back to carnivore sometimes?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so that's a surprising thing that we found. So when we looked at the rates of evolution between these different diets, we actually found that the rate going back from eating just plants was about as high as the rate going forwards too. So basically the rate of going from eating meat to eating plants is about the same as the rate from eating plants going back to meat, which is quite surprising to us. Because it evolved, the feeding on just plants evolved relatively recently.
Right. So herbivore is kind of the newfangled vegan vegetarianism of the animal kingdom. It's kind of a new thing in the history of the world. Yeah.
Well, it's partly a weird thing is that at least the ones that are alive today.
Today, right.
Yeah. So for example, there's these, huge herbivorous dinosaurs like the sauropods and triceratops and things like that. Clearly no longer with us, but much older than the 100 million year old ones that we're seeing today.
So what you and Kristen Sabin worked on was the kind of a predictor of the higher a body temperature, the more possibility that species would be an herbivore.
That's right.
And
that's right.
One, how did you come about even thinking about that temperature, body temperature would be the predominant, not the only determinant, but a determinant for what someone would eat or something would eat?
It's a great question. So actually, people have been talking about this link between body temperature and herbivory for a long time. I actually published a paper on it like 20 years ago in this group of lizards. But it's actually been the case that people have been not quite asking the right question. So people have often asked the question, does what you eat determine your body temperature? And so we actually flipped it around and we asked, does your body temperature help determine what you eat? And you may be thinking, well, those are the same, right? But they're actually not. So basically what we find is that you need to have a high body temperature to evolve to become an herbivore. But you can be, there's no problem with being having a high body temperature and not being an herbivore.
Right.
It's you need the high body temperature to be an herbivore, though.
And the reason for the high body temperature is to keep the stuff alive in your gut, basically, that can digest and move the plant life from eating, a paper plate to turning it into energy and actually have it be something meaningful, right?
That's right. So basically when we're, eating green leaves and things like that, what you're mostly eating, a lot of the protein there is cellulose, right? And to break that down into a form that we can get useful energy from, you need an enzyme called cellulase, right? And we don't make it, but bacteria do. So a lot of the things that are eating just a diet strictly of green plants, they need to have these bacteria that have cellulase. And the thing is, the thinking is that those bacteria only will function if they're exposed, if they're living in a relatively high body temperature, the relatively high body temperature inside their host.
Right. So as I said, I did some research just curious as to what body temperature meant, and I did it in Fahrenheit, which you work in Celsius, but I work in Fahrenheit, and a couple of my little, I just did a half a dozen of them, and I know you're not doing fish, but a crab is, 71 degrees, and a of goldfish is the ambient temperature of the water that they're swimming in. But it was interesting that a giraffe is 101 degrees, and you think wow. about them, they eat a lot of leaves and yep. a lot of up high leaves from the branches. And then a hippopotamus, ironically, is 96.1, okay. which sounds pretty familiar to human beings. But it's interesting that even a giraffe at 101 degrees body temperature, that they are probably going through a lot of herbivore green leaves in a lifetime.
Exactly.
They're eating a ton of the cellulose, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so that heat in their digestive system then is what's keeping the bacteria alive, right?
That's right. And so the bacteria are breaking down the cellulose. Because yeah. the thing is that you can be a vegetarian, right? As a human being, you can be a vegetarian, you can be vegan, but to actually make that work, you can't just eat green leaves. You won't survive that way. So how do people do it? You eat nuts, right? You eat seeds, nuts, and then we also eat a lot of fruits, right? Mm-hmm. But just strictly eating green leaves, that's a tough diet. And generally, we can't do it. As human beings, we can't do that.
The cellulose doesn't break down enough to give you the energy that you need to grow and
that's
prosper.
That's exactly right, you know? Yeah.
So you need the other protein substitutes that come in to make that happen.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. So what's on the horizon for this study now that you've published this and you've gotten a lot of attention on this across the world about you know, asking the right question and maybe coming up with the right answer. Where do you take this from here? What are you going to challenge the next Kristen Sabin to do to look at something? And how do we move this into the understanding of the world around us?
Well, so one thing is that link between the bacteria and the body temperatures, that's not something we actually investigated. And so that's kind of one of the places that this research in this area needs to go. Right. So we think, yeah, you know, it's easy to say that. Right. But it's yeah. somebody there actually isn't really good experimental studies that are strictly showing that.
So that's pretty much the way research is. You make an answer to one thing and then 16 other doors open up and you have to decide which door to go down next.
That's
and,
exactly
and
right.
So, and part of research, publishing research, is to challenge the research community that this is what we think. Now someone needs to go out and do something on that. So maybe some of your undergrad and graduate students will take you up on the offer and begin to look at some of these other items that have come out of this research.
I hope
yeah.
so.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all you do for the young people in your charge. Of course, you teach some classes, right?
That's right. Yeah.
That's fun, isn't it? It's the fun yeah. part of your job, isn't it?
It is pretty fun, yeah.
Yeah. And it's cool when you see people like Kristen Sabin going on and doing great things with her career. Who knows what she's going to be doing in 20 years, but...
something great, I think.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be something great. She's an incredible student, and it's great to have that kind of impact on a student's life, that they can go on and get a doctorate from Harvard and go on and be a biologist and solve some of these issues. So, well, coming up on Tuesday, we have Ted Maxwell, who will host, and then we'll have Grant Kruger on Wednesday. Tom Moulton will be here on Thursday. And I'll be back next Friday, this coming Friday, with business success stories. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson and share your success story, go to jumpintucson.com and let us know a little bit about you. And who knows, maybe you'll be live on the air. Well, thank you, Dr. Wines. I appreciate you being here today and sharing the information on herbivores and temperature, body temperature, and so forth. You've made me hungry. I'm going to go out and get a salad with some protein on it and enjoy a good meal here. So thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me
on. And give our regards to Kristen Sabin. She's a wonderful representative of the University of Arizona, and we wanted her to stay here and do her doctorate, but I guess it's okay that she's at Harvard, so we'll let her slide on that. Jump in Tucson broadcast from the Bustos Media Studios at KVOI 1030 AM Radio. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you will jump in Tucson.